Velkommen til Serieservice med Sissel Astrid Kjærtoft. I det program, du skal lytte til nu, der forsøger Sissel sammen med sine kyndige gæster at gøre os klogere på, hvad det egentlig er, serier kan lære os om den verden, vi lever i. Og kan de overhovedet det? Det får du svar på nu og de næste 55 minutter. Rigtig hjertelig velkommen til Serieservice.
Okay, det værste i verden er ondskab imod dyr og sjælesløse børn. Men lige efter det, der kommer dårlig ledelse. Jeg er ikke selv direktør for noget som helst. Og derfor ved jeg en del om ledelse, fordi jeg lever med det hver eneste fordømte dag. Og når den er dårlig, så er livet næsten ikke til at holde ud. Og når den er god, så er det sandsynligvis, fordi jeg er faldet i søvn, og det er noget, jeg drømmer, eller jeg har set i fjernsynet. Så i dag undersøger vi nemlig, hvad Hamlet, The Wire og Succession kan fortælle os om ledelse. Både den gode og den dårlige. Og i bedste corporate stil vil jeg gøre det her in English.
Nice.
Thank you. Jeg har nemlig fået besøg af hele to professorer fra CBS Leadership. That's why I'm going to swift into English and say, welcome, Professor Robin Holt.
Thank you very much. And thanks for indulging me in speaking English.
Of course. You're always welcome here. And welcome to Associate Professor, I'm sorry, Eric Gothi.
Det er helt i orden.
Yeah, du kan tale lidt dansk, jo.
Kun lidt.
En smule.
Yeah.
Okay, so to start with, what is leadership even?
What is leadership?
Yeah.
Well, you've, Cecil, been in class with me when we asked that very question. And actually, what's funny is with a couple of my colleagues at CBS, anytime we teach a class about leadership anywhere in Copenhagen, in the U.S., we've done this in New Zealand and China and Shanghai and all over the place. We just ask students to start, what is leadership? And you would think that we get different answers in different cultures, but actually, it's pretty uniform that when we ask what is leadership, people don't answer the question, and instead, they describe great leaders. And that says a lot about what people think about leadership, which is they think that leadership is a character that great individuals have, and they think that it's aspirational, that's a great thing. And, you know, we, Robin and I and other scholars, like to make things a little bit more complicated than that. And if you step back and think about it, there's lots of other ways you could describe leadership than just as a character of an individual. First of all, because there's, as you mentioned in your intro, there's so much bad leadership out there.
Exactly.
So many
it's
idiots,
horrible.
So many fools in charge. And, but also, you know, leadership, as we know, and the very fact that we're doing a radio program on it, it speaks to that too, is a valuable cultural commodity that people like to consume in massive quantities. Everybody wants to be a leader and consume more leadership products. It's also an ideology. I think we'll get into that today a little bit. That in many ways, leadership, I'm going to argue when we talk about some of these shows, is a stand-in or a support for patriarchy. That is, old men who won't go away. So there's lots of different ways you could define it. I know that's evasive, but what do you
say? It's a classic academic reply. It's complicated.
Yes, I know.
It depends how you look at it. Just to add to what Eric's saying, then leadership is very important way of securing a sense of certainty or confidence, surety in the midst of otherwise ungovernable events. And it thereby acts as a placeholder, I think, for these anxieties that the condition in which we find ourselves is inherently meaningless and open and untamed. So there's something quite intimate between leadership and what you might call civilized condition or manners. This idea of finding a direction and doing it with a degree of legitimacy. And the leader's position is thereby authorized by that need for certainty. So the authority and the authoring. And this also is why we start to play around with the idea of fiction and leadership. authoring.
Before we get to that, I think that's a really, the way you described it is really good, because there's a way in which when you ask people about leadership, they start to talk back in time to great leaders of the past. But the way you described it, I think, makes clear that there's a certain sense in which the leadership is a very modern phenomenon that I would argue is actually in some way, you know, it's certainly a product of modernity, but also of capitalism, in the sense that we live in a world that's much more uncertain and unclear, and all things melt into air. And in that context, it's comforting to think back to a time when somebody was in charge. And there's, you know, even if we have to pretend that somebody's in charge when they're a complete idiot, it's still that, and that's what I mean by it's an ideology. And so the, especially when we talk about Hamlet and Succession today, I think those two things are endemic of that.
I mean, history, it almost ipso facto, because of the very fact it's a story, his story, is a process of selecting out and sedimenting otherwise contingent events and putting them into a narrative. And I think there's a tendency then to say, okay, well, that's how it was. By definition, you're no longer experiencing it. So there is a sense of security almost in the fact of it being historical. And I think where we look at the current conditions in which we find ourselves, maybe they're no less uncertain than those of the past, but they're certainly uncertain. And it's incredibly pertinent to be discussing this, especially now, as we all have seen.
And that's the perfect for a plug right there. Can we do a plug?
Yes, please do.
We're gonna plug our new album, Robin Holt and Eric Lippe's new album. No, we that very conversation and the fact that it's important to talk about leadership is why CBS has a new leadership initiative that we are both part of. And in fact, the reason we're here today is that Robin presented some of his research in the first faculty seminar as part of that initiative at CBS. And so
on the importance of using fiction, and specifically Hamlet, and we'll go on to talk about The Wire and Succession too.
But how can you use Hamlet to understand leadership?
Yeah, it's incredibly fecund. I mean, clearly, on a very obvious level, this is a leader or a proto-leader or a would-be leader.
Okay, so
it's a play about a figure who is destined to become a leader and is harangued and invaded by, disturbed by the appearance of his father, the old leader, and discovers that his father's been murdered by the current leader, his uncle, Claudius, and he's duty-bound to take revenge as an honorable son and as a upholder of the standard ways of being a leader. He's exhorted to kill Claudius and to restore himself to the rightful position.
Okay, so is Prince Hamlet, is he the CEO? Or is Claudius the CEO?
Claudius is the CEO, but he ought not be.
Okay.
Because we're talking about an interesting period where the leader was in an assumed position of kind of patriarchal dominance, and by right, the title would pass from father to the eldest son.
Yeah.
And Claudius has intervened. Hamlet's away in university, being a student somewhere, Wittenberg. And during his absence, Claudius has stepped in, committed a foul deed, killed old Hamlet, and usurped the role because he was, in a sense, the next. He was also has a slight claim as a family member, but we're dealing with a situation in which the title of leader is somehow assumed to be part of the DNA of a familial unit, and it may seem antique, but it's still quite prevalent. If one looks at large organizations, certainly if one looks at the political classes, if you look at media organizations that we'll come on to discuss, there is a nepotistic element in many organizations with regard to the leaders they choose. So it's not just historical. And what's intriguing about the situation in Denmark for Hamlet, when he comes, he's exhorted to extract or to find some form of evidence for why he should follow his father's instruction to kill Claudius. At the very moment that he tries to find extra evidence, rather than just listen to his father, rather than just sort of follow his father's command, we've got this really interesting pause, and there's a shift from the antique to the modern, because suddenly Hamlet's not in play in the standard way. He's not doing the familial thing. He's not performing his duty. He's trying to look outside of the family relations, which are just purely instinctual, generationally sedimented. And he's trying to do something called thinking. And it's that that really starts to sort of screw things up and generate a lot of dramatic action.
Okay, so if you are a leader, you should, or you shouldn't think?
Well, yeah, to think.
or to act.
Yeah, to sort of play around with the famous phrase. It's, if one takes it back to the idea of this antique norm, the patriarchy, the organization is akin to a house. In Greek, a house is oikos, and that's the root word for economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the root word for administration. And the head of the economy, the head of the administration, is a patriarchal male figure. And their responsibility is to keep order, to keep the oikos together. And it's kept together through violence. It's violence done in order to preserve peace. In other words, the sound ordering of the oikos is constituted by war, and the threats to the oikos are repelled, other oikos are absorbed into the ordering of your own. And this is how it is. This is it's the relations are entirely ones of violence and power. And what Hamlet does, having been schooled in Wittenberg, and he's a newly minted humanist, and it's this cusp. He's one of these funny figures that looks back to the antique and looks forward to the modern. He lives on the cusp a little, and he's suggesting, well, maybe there's another way of relating to this role, rather than just this being a relation of power. It could also be a relation of meaning, of actually constituting something thoughtfully, thinking through the condition rather than just acting. But then if you think too much, nothing gets done. And this is...
Then you'd be paralyzed.
Yeah.
You'd be an academic.
You would be. Yeah. You don't do anything, you just think. Yeah, very good. And so much of the interpretation of Hamlet since it was written, 1599, 1600, has been concentrating on this figure, this vacillating figure, this figure that refuses to make a decision, this figure who is, in a sense, a failed leader because he can't act. And this reading has almost become instinctual. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's inaccurate, but it's very hard to shift. And it's informed the thinking of many other thinkers on leadership, notably German sort of fascist constitutional theorist Carl Schmitt, who very famously equates Hamlet to a proto-liberal figure. A liberal is someone who refuses to take their own side in an argument. A liberal is someone who can't act, who's constantly looking for affirmation or different opinions, or constantly trying to seek consensus.
And make everybody happy.
And make everyone happy, but in doing that, not really achieving anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's Schmitt's objection. And he calls this is like the Hamlet problem. This is the Hamlet condition. And he thinks the whole of Western Europe has been is bedeviled with the Hamlet problem, is that we can't act resolutely, we have no spine, we have no commitment to a set of values that for which we should be standing tall. And
America great again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it is a very nostalgic and backward-looking. Mm-hmm. Schmidt is a very, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. his connections with unfortunate political currents.
Absolutely.
He's mm-hmm. very much in that way we were talking about before, looking backwards to a type of authority that yeah. is comforting to some, but.
Yeah, and he is, I mean, he's a very, he is a thoughtful, ironically, mm-hmm. a thoughtful guy. And his reading, though, is very singular. And he feels he's isolated a condition which we all acknowledge and, in a sense, extricate ourselves from. And so become a little more like old Hamlet.
Mm.
Or perhaps a little more like Claudius, or perhaps a little more like Fortinbras, because these are different forms of acting leader. And that's the question that one ought to be asking, I think, is if we find Hamlet to be irresolute and vacillating and filibustering with himself, and that's not something we want a more active leader, then what type of active leader do we need or want or desire?
There's a... It's an excellent reading that we use with many students, and from executive students to undergraduates, that provides the counterpoint to that view of leadership. And it's a piece called The Seven Surprises for New CEOs, and it's all about how surprised, and the piece was written on the basis of a survey of 10 years' worth of participants in a workshop at Harvard for new CEOs. And it sort of crunched down the seven things they were most surprised about. And the very first one was, you can't run the company.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was giving orders is very costly. And all these things that you couldn't do and how the thing they were most surprised about was how being in a position of formal leadership actually constrained their agency. And if they did, for example, take an action, they would cut off some of their subordinates at the knees and they wouldn't be allowed to take action. And so there was all these ways in which, you know, there's an argument for leadership as a form of negative capability. We actually had a student doing an exam yesterday and mm-hmm. it was an internship exam, and she was talking about the leader of this company she was in. She decided that he was basically just doing leadership on demand, and that whenever it wasn't needed, he didn't do any leadership at all and stayed mm-hmm. in the background, because otherwise it would all just muck things up. So there is a whole set of theories that are the opposite of that mm-hmm. very masculine, active idea.
Yeah, yeah. And I think even within it, it's interesting. So old Hamlet's a very uncomplicated
mm-hmm.
version of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
He gets up, takes his sword, gets on a horse, goes, waves the sword around, comes back, puts the sword away, you know, has a drink, goes, you know, whatever.
That sounds okay.
That's about it. Yeah?
Do we know any leaders who are like this?
Nay. I mean,
is it a Steve Jobs kind of leader?
No. This is it's impossible. I mean, in a sense, it's a slight sort of caricature, but there is something quite, in a sense, predictable, interesting about that predictability, and there is a certainty about it, but it rests on the condition that no one will question it, and if he's required to do any more, he's singularly unable. And in many ways, Claudius was perhaps right. This guy's getting on. Yeah, he's old. He has to have a sleep in the afternoon. And he lies in the orchard, you know, having a rest. And Claudius comes up and, you know, does for him.
Yeah.
And okay, so here we have a more active, a more engaged mm-hmm. figure who's getting rid of the old leader, who's kind of tired, yeah? It's like this aging silverback who can't cope anymore. I mean, I'm just...
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Just really quick. When Claudius kills old Hamlet, is he like the board who just decides to fire a CEO?
I'm just
trying to
Yeah.
Understand.
I mean,
business.
We're in a rotten state. Yeah, Denmark is a rotten state. This is accepted. So yeah, this guy's got to take responsibility for the rotten state. Old Hamlet's, you know, not been doing a good job. Claudius comes like, okay, I'm gonna sort this mess out. And you have a much more, in Claudius, you have a much more pragmatic, Machiavellian-like figure. By Machiavellian, I mean this in a kind of slightly neutral way, in the sense that he's got cunning, but he's got this practical nous, this practical capacity. We meet him at the start of the play. He's meeting ambassadors. He's trying to sort out the trip for someone to Paris. He's doing things, huh, in a way that probably old Hamlet didn't. Yeah. And he seems quite effective. And there's a sense in which he's prepared to throw himself into events and to allow those events to wash over him, and he becomes very clever at reading situations. There's a situational cunning about the way he is. So, and at one point, Hamlet's slightly respectful of this. I mean, well, why not let the guy carry on? He's going to be maybe quite good at it. Yeah. So there's one of the seeds of doubt that is planted in his mind when he starts to ask whether he should obey his father or not. So I think Claudius is another style of action.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fortinbras is yet another one, who's the son of old Fortinbras, who's a Norwegian. He's the upstart, he's the young, and sort of, and he's much more in the way of a almost like a son. He has this kind of preening, confident, youthful vigor. And I guess in part he acts like old Hamlet, but he's also got this assumed sense of preeminence that allows him to posture in a way that old Hamlet would simply just assume the patriarchal role. Fortinbras wants to embellish it and to adorn it, yeah? And so we have these different forms of active leader that are all kind of vying with one another for attention, our attention in the audience. And Hamlet's version, the one that I like to stress, is the idea of the thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So action is accompanied by, installed by, and interrupted by thought. And for me, I think it's the most pregnant, it's the most free, it's the most generative example in the play that we have. But it's also the one that's most easily criticized because nothing apparently happens. But this guy's tortured. He's trying to think through, yeah, so many different ways of looking at things. But he arrives at an intelligence. He has an intelligence for the situation that the others lack in some ways, because what he tries to do, unlike Claudius, who is also, like I said, situationally sensitive, Hamlet tries to also invest that situational sensitivity with some commitment to principles or some form of reasoned warrant for acting. It's not just surviving circumstances. There has to be more. And so I think, going back to the question you asked us at the start, what is leader? If we follow through on Hamlet, I mean, I think he's trying to invest Denmark with a reason for being. One of the questions that we ask the students, and what would the world be like if this organization did not exist? So if this radio station didn't exist, if CBS didn't exist, would the world miss us?
Probably not.
And if it wouldn't, then we're not doing anything.
Yeah? Exactly.
And a leader, I mean, Hamlet's asking those kind of questions. So what is Denmark? I mean, it's rotten. No one would miss it. It's a prison like all the other prisons. In fact, it's a really good version. It's a goodly prison, he says. But could it be something more uplifting? Could it contribute to our flourishing in some way? And if it can't, then it shouldn't exist. And I think he's pushing us slightly towards these kind of questions, which sounds rather noble, but you know, it's also quite important that we at least consider why the organization is around.
Should we hear something from Hamlet?
Let's do that.
Which one would you like?
I think we play Claudius. Should we play Claudius?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, the Claudius Club.
Okay. Yeah. Shall I?
Please introduce the scene.
Is the Andrew Scott version.
Yeah, yeah. So the scene is Hamlet's been considering how to supplement his old Hamlet's, his father's request that he kill Claudius with some evidence, because he doesn't really want to trust the word of a ghost. You know, it could be just a devil playing with his mind. I mean, it's not a very sufficient warrant for the action, especially such an extreme one. And he's arrived at the solution of having some actors play out a play in which the very same crime that Claudius committed.
It's called the mousetrap.
It's called the mousetrap. So he's setting a trap. And his idea is to look at Claudius, how he reacts. And if Claudius blenches, it's a beautiful word. In other words, if he feels uncomfortable, if he then he's got his evidence. Then he knows, okay, yeah, this guy really did do it. And so the play's played out, and Claudius runs. So this is as much evidence as he needs. Claudius has quit the scene, even. He can't cope with seeing his offence played out by these amazing actors. And he runs straight to the chapel, church, and starts to pray for forgiveness. And so this is Claudius praying for forgiveness. And Hamlet has chased after him.
And is listening in.
Yeah.
My offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it. A brother's murder. Pray, can I not, though inclination be as sharp as will, my stronger guilt defeats my strong intent, and like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause. Where shall I first begin? And both neglect. What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? And what's in prayer but this twofold force, to be forestalled before we come to fall, or pardoned being down? And I'll look up. My fault is past. But oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder. That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder, my crown, my own ambition, and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense. In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and often it's seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law, but it is not so above. There is no shuffling there. The action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled, even to the teeth and forehead of our faults, to give in evidence. So what then? What rests? Try what repentance can. What can it not? Yet what can it when one cannot repent? Your wretched state, oh bosom black as death, oh limed soul that's struggling to be free, art more ensnared. Help! Angels! Make a say. Bow stubborn knees, and heart with strings of steel be soft as sinews of the newborn babe. All may be well.
Now might I do it, now he is a praying. And now I'll do it. And so he goes to heaven. And so am I revenged. That would be scanned. A villain kills my father. And for that, I, his sole son, do this same villain send to heaven. Why, this is higher in salary. Not revenge. He took my father grossly, full of bread, with all his crimes broad blown, as flush as May. And am I then revenged to take him in the purging of his soul when he is fit and seasoned for his passage? No, when he's drunk, asleep, or in his rage, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed, then trip him that his heels may kick at heaven, and that his soul may be as damned and black as hell, whereto it goes. My mother stays. This physic but prolongs thy sickly days.
My words fly up. My thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go.
So here we have, it's an amazing speech, soliloquy. I mean, we have someone who's admitting that he has to stay with the pragmatics of the situation. He's appealing to heaven, he's appealing for forgiveness. He understands the criminality that's kind of shadowing his existence. And yet he's able to box it and to live on and to stay with the thoughts in this life and to keep his crown and to keep his ambition and to keep his queen and to keep shuffling. If you recall halfway through, also he talked about there's no shuffling up in the realm of principles. But here it's all about shuffling. And leadership is shuffling. And he's an adept at this. And Hamlet now knows that the crime's been committed. And this is a tipping point in the play because now Hamlet can act. And he does start to act after this. So it's not that he's vacillating and refuse, but he's secured evidence. And this then impels him into a much more active figure during the play.
So this moment make him able to become a leader?
Of a certain type.
In that definition.
Yeah. I mean, I think the willingness to invest himself in securing evidence and to think through how he should be outside of the regimen of the patriarchal system, to think of about leadership in relations of meaning and not relations of power, it's difficult. And I mean, what Hamlet does is he extends the idea of leadership. So it's not just leading an organization. It's not just leading the oikos, the household. It's actually leading yourself. Yeah, and so much of the play is this interior life that we're privy to as the audience, but not the surrounding characters. He soliloquizes to us. And he understands there's an intimacy between leading your own life, understanding your life as something that needs to be led, and not just something that needs to be suffered or endured. Or it's not just existence, and leading an organization. And he tries to align these and to bring character, ethos, ethics is to bear on both himself and the organization.
So let me push back on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about this the other day. You could read this in a very different way. And mm-hmm. I to back up a little bit and talk about something we said we would do. It must seem odd to your listeners to hear two business professors sitting here talking about Hamlet. And we should talk a tiny bit about why we would use fiction to do business research. And it struck me when you said the word evidence there, that's a good way into mm-hmm. that discussion mm-hmm. because so much of what we do at business schools is expected to be quote-unquote evidence-based and scientific and factual. But when you push on the things that we do at business schools, it's very much about fiction. I mean, organizations themselves are legal fictions. They don't really exist. You can't take a picture of a CBS or a Demoxolatio. Mm-hmm. Because they don't exist in the world in that way. They are just basically fictions that make relationships more convenient. And in that, from that perspective, it's really helpful to think about fictions and how they structure. You know, and then since we have to talk organizations into existence, we have to draw on tropes and stories like this one to do it. And so, you know, rich traditions of literature and fiction are basically the resources for that. So if we don't understand those resources, we can't talk about business and organizations in the right way.
I mean, and to extemporize a little on this, the evidence Hamlet uses is a piece of fiction. It's a play.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's employing a fictional device.
He's like you guys.
Yeah. And he himself is incredibly attentive to the power of the fictional.
See, but this is where I had to part with you on this reading.
The play is, he's enamored of the players of the play.
Yeah.
He understands all leaders, it's a role. You
on
play the role.
On the other hand, he excoriates women throughout this play for their artifice, for the fact that they're playing a role. At one point he says that God gives women one face and they paint on another one. And everything about this play. So what I like about the way you're doing this research is that it exemplifies the fact that we in business schools pretend that we don't make choices in our research, but you're being very explicit about interpretation is a choice. Mm-hmm. And we both come from backgrounds where that's academic backgrounds where that's an important thing. But we talked the other day about how there's choices that Shakespeare didn't make here, or, you know, the way he tells the story constrains certain people's choices. So in this, you know, and the risk of focusing too much on men and their games how they, even if they're agonizing over their games in which they compete with each other, focusing on that too much doesn't bring up the fact that with this play turns Gertrude into a whore. Mm. This play erases Ophelia's mother entirely. This play drives Ophelia herself crazy. If you think about it, Polonius tells his son Laertes to thine own self be true, but he compels his daughter to lie to Hamlet in a way that that drives her insane. And so, you know, I read the play, or the way I'm reading the play these days doesn't really add up to Hamlet being a figure that's questioning the patriarchy, but the whole play itself seems to me to reinforce a patriarchy and a patriarchal view of what leadership could be.
Mm. I mean, he is this watershed figure. He exhibits the antique as much as he exhibits the modern.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the modern can replace the antique in interesting ways, and the continual kind of exploitation and of minorities and different gender. It's just a deeply misogynist play.
Yeah.
As many of Shakespeare's plays are. And that's just how we have to take it and accept it. And it's also very interesting because the misogyny that Hamlet exhibits is not the misogyny that old Hamlet exhibits. So the modern element, the thoughtful element, and we'll hear it in the next quote if we have time.
Definitely.
What is a man?
Yeah.
So it becomes a question. It's not an assumption. And so you've got this opening, albeit he is profoundly misogynist. The very fact that it's become a question is this opening up to something else.
But it's not a question when he says, frailty, thy name is woman. It's a declarative statement.
Yeah. But it is still... It asks very interesting questions about gender, this play. And they're typically directed towards the condition of the male.
Mm-hmm.
But even questioning it's more than the antique. It's disturbing the antique in interesting ways.
We haven't talked about this. Do you know the Reduced Shakespeare Company?
Mm-hmm.
This comedy troupe. And they actually recently had a production called Hamlet's Big Adventure, the prequel. And they go back and they imagine all the events that led up to these events, but it's done as a comedy instead of a tragedy.
Yeah.
And they try to fill in the holes of why this is the way it is.
I mean, Hamlet's been played by many female actresses.
Yep.
And increasingly so. And when you're with performances with female act, you get a different kind of Hamlet, of course. But they still are able to inhabit it in a very electric sense, because it's raising questions of gender as well. It's germane. Yeah. It seems appropriate that they can play this. And it's fantastic that they do. And it's something that there's a famous Danish actress, Asta Nielsen, from the 1920s, who did a famous silent film of Hamlet. And Sarah Bernhardt. Anyway, there's a whole litany of female people, actresses who have taken on this role. So,
okay, do you want to go on to The Wire, or do you want to listen to the Hamlet?
I think we can go to The Wire.
Okay.
Because we haven't...
We're short on time.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, let's go to The Wire. We haven't.
Great. Okay, so please introduce The Wire to me. I have never seen it.
The Wire?
Oh, you've never seen The Wire?
Okay. No.
Okay.
I'm so uneducated, I know.
The writer, one of the writers, David Simon, described it as a novel for television. He also described it as an investigation of global capitalism masquerading as a police procedural, which is quite a nice way of...
And it's more Dickens than it is Shakespeare. In that sense, what's cool about it is that, and this is why it's an interesting counterpoint to what we've been discussing, it's much more about... It's a fancy academic word, but social. It's much more about how agency is not a part of something an individual has.
Mm-hmm.
It's about it's about institutions and society and how what happens in society is not just a function of great men who agonize or not.
Yep.
It's more about the relationships and how people fit inside institutions and how organizations work. And that makes it a really compelling counterpoint to what we've been talking about.
Yeah, it does. And
the division of leadership, therefore, is very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's much more... if this makes it any, it's much more pessimistic than Hamlet. It's,
and Hamlet is so joyful.
Yeah. Yeah. It ends. Yeah.
Well,
let the soldiers shoot. But it is the Wire is an incredible foray into a condition of precarity, the spectre of uselessness, the risk of the shame or the stain of cowardice, the resilience of human beings, the sort of pockets of joy that one might experience amid these incredibly pervasive institutional forces.
What can you learn
forces.
About the leadership from watching it?
To me, what it reveals more than anything is the impossibility of thought, which is why I think it's more depressing than Hamlet. No sooner do you show initiative than you're squashed.
Yeah.
That's what the Wire...
And
any scenario, if you're mayor, if you're running the police, if you're running a drug, any attempt to break from what they call the game,
the logic of
the logic of, mm-hmm. yeah, the logic of the way in which all of us scripted is crushed. It
is depressing.
It's just relentless.
And it sets up this parallel between the police and the drug organization the police are trying to stop, mm-hmm. and they both operate in the same exact way.
Yeah. Should we play the Hamsterdam clip?
Yeah. That's the one from the first season, right?
No, from season 3.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Somewheres back in the dawn of time, this district had itself a civic dilemma of epic proportion. The city council had just passed a law that forbid alcoholic consumption in public places, on the streets, and on the corners. But the corner is, and it was, and it always will be, the poor man's lounge. It's where a man wants to be on a hot summer's night. It's cheaper than a bar, you catch a nice breeze, you watch your girls go by. But the law is a law. The Western cops rolling by, what were they gonna do? They arrested every dude out there for tipping back a high life. There'd be no other time for any other kind of police work. And if they looked the other way, they'd open themselves to all kinds of flaunting, all kind of disrespect. Now, this is before my time when it happened, but somewhere back in the 50s or 60s, there was a small moment of goddamn genius by some nameless smoke hound who comes out to cut rate one day, and on his way to the corner, he slips that just bought pint of elderberry into a paper bag. A great moment of civic compromise. That small, wrinkle-ass paper bag allowed the corner boys to have their drink in peace, and it gave us permission to go and do police work. The kind of police work that's actually worth the effort. That's worth actually taking a bullet for. Dozerman, you got shot last night trying to buy 3 vials. 3. There's never been a paper bag for drugs. Until now.
So here we have a police major, Colvin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful rhetorical speech. I mean, as a lesson in how to persuade your followers, if you will, of the legitimacy of an innovative move. He's attempting to make a paper bag for drugs. So the equivalent to hiding the liquor bottle in the paper bag, which allowed people to turn a blind eye to what was an offense. He's detailed part of the city of Baltimore to be a free zone for dealing drugs. And he wants to put all of the drug trade into one area, thereby freeing up the surrounding community and allowing them to go ahead with their everyday lives so it doesn't blight the whole city. And allowing the police to concentrate their attention in one space. And if there's no trouble, there's no trouble. And then they can go off and do real police work elsewhere. So it's a beautifully imaginative, entrepreneurial response. And it works. Crime rate falls. The drug gangs are happy doing their trade. But it's illegal.
And that's a problem.
And initially, the civic leaders and Colvin's bosses are super impressed because they don't live on the streets. They don't do the work in the everyday sense. They live in these abstract spaces. And they're all of them obsessed with statistics, performance measures, to the point where they'll even manipulate the performance measures as long as it works out in their favor. So they look at this lovely phrase they have, juke the stats. Huh? And because the crime rate's falling, according to the figures, they're happy. And they don't want to look any more closely. They're not interested in what's happening. So the experiment survives for quite a while until a journalist gets hold of it and starts to question, well, what's going on here? And it gets, and then, of course, it becomes public. And then the leaders step in, Colvin's bosses, and go, what the hell are you doing, you know? And he goes, yeah, but come on, you know, this is a piece of civic compromise. This is a lovely way of trying to make the best of a bad situation. It's kind of Claudius-like, it's pragmatic, it's cunning, but it's got a sort of warrant, it's a legitimacy to it. It's not just to elevate Colvin. It's not just to make him look good. But they sit on it because they can't possibly tolerate the illegality in the abstract. They fear for their own positions. So they're not prepared to back Colvin, and they force him to shut it down. And this is what happens to in a very depressing way, you know, it happens.
Yeah, over and over and over again.
Yeah, over and over. And any attempt to show, to change, to shift, yeah, it's just squashed. And so leadership is just these little pockets of these blooming weeds that then get stamped on, yeah? And it really is relentless. And I think it's quite realistic in the sense that I think all of us can appreciate we live in organizational conditions where performance measures, structures, rules, in a sense, they constrain us to such a degree. The room for self-expression, for leading a life in Hamlet's sense, becomes incredibly restricted. And leading is then just, in a sense, being led by, yeah, by an institutional structure, by a regime, which is in itself headless and heedless. So it's a very curious form of leadership because you defer to this very emotionless and insistent structure called performance measurement or the law.
I mean, I think you might be stacking the deck a little bit there in the sense that it's what you're really talking about is a wager or a bargain or a balance between collective agency on the one hand and seems to be the expediency of just, fuck it, we'll just do it this way, you know, authoritarianism on the other hand. And it's, you know, either it's easy to paint democracy itself as, you know, restrictive and boring and, you know, this is precisely what opponents of any move towards diversity do. Mm-hmm. They claim that it's stifling my creativity, you know, that I have to think about these things at all. But, you know, it's very difficult to maintain a balance between those two things because you don't want some capricious authority figure to just barge in and get things done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you don't want things to be so stifled that nothing ever happens. It's a very difficult sweet spot to find.
It is. And there are examples, again, in The Wire, that where this kind of entrepreneurial agency is really egregious. It's really... So there's a fantastic figure, Burrell, who's the police commissioner. So he's the boss of Colvin. And he's the one that plays this statistical game, and he's incredibly entrepreneurial about juking the stats. Mm-hmm. So he thinks he's got a run on the system. So he's the mayor is his. So there's leaders of leaders in this. So the mayor's going, I want the crime figures reduced. Bubbles going, I will reduce the crime figures. And then he does everything he can in very entrepreneurial way to try and get the figures down. Huh? And but that's as far as his entrepreneurship goes. It's this very kind of surface level, cynical, embittered, and just empty sort of play with possibility. So there's no decency in it. It's just surviving. And
is leadership just surviving?
Well, that's what it seems to come down to in many of the instances in Burrell, or they just need to keep their position. So the mayor just wants to do everything he can to get elected the next time. The police commissioner wants to do everything he can to stay in the position, and it's all hymns, right? To stay as the police commissioner. Yeah. Colvin's the only one who's prepared to risk his position, and he does, and he ends up losing it. So he's no longer a major after this experiment.
He's the one that adopts the one boy off the street.
He's spat out. Huh?
Eric, is Succession as depressive as The Wire?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about Succession is that it's a tragedy played as a comedy, for one thing. So it's funnier. I mean, The Wire is very funny. There's some amazing comedy in The Wire, but there's a big debate about whether Succession is. Succession is almost like a, if we consider it a Hamlet to be a very thoughtful take on a very pre-modern authoritarian style of leadership, we consider The Wire to be a very modern meditation on the limits of collective leadership and institutions and how broken they're always going to be, then Succession is like this, what would you call this, sort of relapse back to raw masculine power and energy in the figure of this, of Logan Roy. This, you know, that what's fascinating about Succession is that the play that we started with, Hamlet, was written during a period that the entire England was in a massive succession crisis for years. And it's definitely directly addressing that. And the whole of Succession is about a massive succession crisis where the patriarch figure of this company is supposed to be a sort of an amalgam of Trump and Murdoch. He's supposed to step down, and then he has a stroke, and then he doesn't step down, and his kids are left fighting. And so the queer parallel is to King Lear, but there's lots of direct references to Hamlet in it as well, and joking references about Shakespeare, so and how Shakespearean it is. It's so raw in it's less nuanced. I would say The Wire is the best fictive depiction of organizational politics that we have ever had. Succession is a more action movie version of that, right? I mean, it's very.
I mean, to go back to the idea,
lots of
it's a different form of fiction, huh?
And so
Succession has a strong narrative. There's a team of writers who are employed to entertain and to seduce an audience. Whereas The Wire was deliberately difficult, and it refused to have this closed set of narratives and this each episode finishing on a cliff. I mean, those things are just abandoned by David Simon.
Yeah.
And when he was asked, it's difficult to follow, huh? I mean, don't you have a view for how the average viewer should? And he goes, just fuck the average viewer.
Yeah,
this is not for you. This is what I want to produce. This is this is life. Yeah. Life does not end on cliffhangers in this. Life is like this. Huh? And so you have to sort of immerse yourself in The Wire in a way that you don't necessarily with other forms of fiction. It's just a different fictional kind of form.
Mm-hmm.
And
now I'm going to end the discussion.
Oh, boy. So class is over.
Yeah. I know, class is over. Thank you so much, Robin Holt and Eric Guthy.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having
thank
us.
Thank you so much.
And for talking in English.
Appreciate
it.
That's no problem. Nu siger jeg til gengæld noget på dansk. Hvis man vil se Hamlet og blive lidt deprimeret, men på en rigtig lækker engelsk måde, så kan man jo finde det alle mulige steder. Man kan enten læse det eller se det. Til gengæld kan man se The Wire og Succession på HBO.